Today, we speak to the first ever Europe editor for respected business publication Forbes. But here on the show, as we cater to all types of magazine fans, alongside the business, we need a little pleasure too. So we'll hear from the editor of More or Less, a new biannual adding some fun to the newsstand. All that ahead this week on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on the programme, we speak to the former creative director of British Vogue about her biannual title, More or Less, and we profile another new magazine all about female pleasure, so stay tuned for that. But first, it is a pleasure to welcome, for the first time to The Stack studio, but a welcome back to our Monocle studios, Alex Wood, who's been the Europe editor of Forbes for almost precisely a year. Before that, he founded UK online publication The Memo, which was acquired by Forbes, as we said, about 12 months ago. Alex, great to have you with us. Well, let's reflect on that, first of all. I think it's almost, give or take, to the day, a year. What a 12 months it's been.
It's been an absolute rollercoaster. And yes, it is fantastic timing that it is almost exactly 1 year. Such a huge shift for me personally, and also for the Forbes brand. Just really reflecting on the whole journey of being an entrepreneur myself, also writing about entrepreneurs and now transitioning off into a much bigger media company, which at its heart is about entrepreneurship.
And let's talk about this idea of a pivot, I suppose, as it was, or certainly a recalibration of the view towards Europe. We said the first person to hold that post. What have you learned about, I guess, the world of Forbes and its view towards Europe? This is obviously a slightly loaded question with what's going on here in London moment to do with Europe. But what have you learned in that regard over the last year?
I think it's been really interesting because there was definitely an awareness that Forbes is a brand that is well known everywhere across the world. But particularly in Europe, I think it has a perception of being quite an American brand. You know, you think of the Warren Buffetts, for example, and a lot of the brash American capitalists that you'd have on the front cover. And it's been really interesting because when I speak to people across Europe, they get so excited about the brand. And really, my strategy over the last 12 months has been about re-engaging with it and also looking beyond the UK. Obviously, it's been fascinating and an interesting piece of timing to be becoming a European editor at a time when the UK is going through this kind of crisis. But actually, one of my real passions is about giving a voice to the voiceless. And I actually think that particularly out of the English-speaking world, when we looked at the map of Europe in terms of our coverage as well, we looked at our contributor base, which I'd love to talk about more. We really wanted to make sure and focus that we had a diverse view set across the whole continent, not just from the UK and Ireland, but going all the way across to the eastern side of Europe as well.
And Alex, I'm sure this won't be the first time you've been asked this question, as you mentioned, over the last 12 months, but depending on what happens, and we could be really only sort of days away from something rather disastrous in terms of the UK relationship with Europe, can you still be sat in London and have the same connection with exactly the demographics that you're talking to? Or is it the kind of thing where someone will say, well, surely you'll need to be sat in Brussels or in Frankfurt or in Hamburg or in Paris or in Berlin or wherever it might be?
I can see why people would think that. I think we should always remind ourselves that even if we do leave the European Union, we still are in Europe. And London is still going to be a key place. And I reference that back to the experience of someone who's been covering the startup community for the best part of a decade in London. And I think one of London's greatest strengths is the way that it is a magnet for talent across Europe, and often the bridge to take people across the US as well, being an English-speaking country, but also in terms of our legal system, it is that natural bridge to take you over to New York or over to the Valley if you're a tech company. And so I don't see that necessarily changing. And the people that I speak to in the startup community are obviously upset. There's a lot of emotion that's going on. However, the fundamentals about London, the fact that we can step outside this door right now and see some of the best food in the entire world, we can see some of the best culture, those things are not going to go away. I'm not going to pretend that it's not going to be fun and it's not going to be easy if we leave the European Union, but I still see London and the UK as still a core part of Europe. And that relationship, whatever form it takes, is still important.
All those great restaurants, they haven't run out of lettuce yet.
Not yet.
This is a conversation.
I mean, that is something I am worried about.
A conversation for another day. I guess it's interesting to reflect then on the complexities of all these different supranational relationships. What about within Forbes? Because you've already alluded to the fact of how international it is and how huge a sort of beast it is. Lots of different international editions and all these kind of complex interests which all interlock. Has that in itself been a tricky course to navigate? Or do you find that all the different moving parts, they're very much in tune with one another?
I think one of the most surprising things I found after joining the company, and I have to be honest in saying, and many entrepreneurs would say this, that when you go from having your own business to going into a bigger business, there's a certain apprehension. You know, you're letting go of a lot of control. You're thinking about, you know, how is it going to work? I'm going to have to learn processes and, you know, big grown-up stuff that doesn't necessarily happen in startups. But actually, genuinely, it has been a surprise. This company is 102 years old, but I genuinely believe it is entrepreneurial. And one of the first things that surprised me when I got there, got into the senior management meeting on my first morning in New York, completely jet lagged. And inside that room, I'd say there were at least five or six people on the senior management team who were former entrepreneurs, including my boss, Randall Lane, who is the overall editor. And it changes the culture of a business, the CTO as well, when we all come from that kind of mindset. And so, yes, we are an old business, but we are given a huge amount of freedom and we are given opportunities to innovate. And you can see that in what Forbes has done, particularly in the last 10 years with the contributor model, with branded content as well. And it's really started to feed through. But to come to your point about the international local language editions, that was a really big surprise for me because I have to put my hands up and say that I had no idea that there was a French Forbes and there was an Italian Forbes until I joined the company. And over the course of the first 6 months, I had a real sort of light bulb moment where I realized that actually, if you put together the staff that are inside those organizations and also the contributors they have, by my reckoning, we have more boots on the ground than any other publication in Europe. And these are local language experts. You know, it's all well and good sending a correspondent out to be in Rome for a year or so, but actually to have people who live and breathe and understand that. So that's going to be a big focus for me over the next 2 years. I'm actually amusingly almost trying to build a European Union from London at the moment. And I'm trying to find ways that I can work with those different editors, because I think if we can tie together some of that amazing talent we have across the continent, we can actually present a really interesting viewpoint.
Alex, that's definitely interesting. I love the idea. I'd like to be a fly on the wall on some of those senior management meetings. But this idea of media brands, which are heritage titles or whatever you want to call them, but that, who seem to be able to strike that balance between adhering to the traditions, which their readers love, but still being innovative. And, you know, even on this programme, we talk to some people who find that path just simply too difficult to navigate. Is it precisely that entrepreneurialism that seems to run through, if you like, the DNA, and it's a cliche, but of those people? Is that why there's a readier engagement with that balance? Because a lot of established brands, they've either gone altogether, or they're enduring tough times, or they're dabbling in digital not very effectively, and then they sometimes even abandon print altogether. Why are Forbes getting it right?
I think from my very personal perspective and my experience over the last year, I think a lot of it is to do with the acquisitions the company has made. They've made a series of acquisitions that have brought some really talented people into the business who have completely transformed things, particularly in digital. So the CTO brought some amazing ideas along with him as well. And I also think it comes down to that culture at the very heart of the business. The Forbes family are still very much part of the company. I was so touched to receive Christmas cards from them this year as well, you know, personal Christmas cards. And it doesn't feel like a giant beast of a media company. It feels like a family company. And what I've seen in that year is that when people have ideas like mine about tying together the different European language licenses together, or 30 Under 30, which is one of the most fascinating part of Forbes, because a lot of people perceive Forbes as the Warren Buffett billionaires list magazine, but actually the 30 Under 30 is by far the most important part of what we do now. And so we're this magazine that's covering two extremes, you know, the billionaires of tomorrow and the billionaires of today. And 30 Under 30 was something that happened really organically and was allowed to develop almost as a startup within the business and is now hugely successful. And I think when other people start to see that, yes, I can do it, yes, I can put my neck on the line, go and create something, I think it just grows and grows.
And where does the trusty print edition sit in that universe? Is it still at the very centre? I mean, even reflecting on our chairman here, Tyler Brulé, who always talks about Monocle, the magazine stays at the heart. We have all these exciting radio and all the rest of it, but the mag's at the centre. Is that the same? Is that another reason perhaps why there's such a reassuring familiarity for many readers?
I think the magazine is still very much a core part of what we do, but it is one part and everything feeds into each other. So I still think when you look at it jokingly, but you hear songs like Bruno Mars, I Want to Be on the Cover of Forbes magazine, it speaks to how powerful, and we say internally that it is the most valuable real estate in the media world. You know, there are so many people out there that want to have that front cover shoot, and that's not going to go away, but it's about how we translate that excitement into digital products as well. And so a lot of things have been changing now where we're actually trying to translate the excitement of print into some of the presentational formats we do online. That's been interesting. So Kylie Jenner's been a good example of that, where she was on the front cover, had a huge amount of interest and prompted, you know, press speculation across the world. But also we took that story further in digital as well.
Let's talk a bit about editorial approach, I suppose. Has this whole narrative about fake news, accuracy, fact-checking, the rigours of what I would sort of call traditional journalism, is that an ongoing narrative? I mean, how have you and your colleagues within the Forbes sort of family been navigating that?
It's still something that's really important to us. We're not afraid to take a point of view at Forbes, and that's something that I really love. We don't necessarily pretend to be like the likes of Reuters or Bloomberg that often have pure data services or information. Fact-checking is actually something that is really core, and I got first-hand experience of just how hardcore our fact-checking is. So in month three of joining Forbes, I was asked to have President Macron on the front cover of the magazine, which you really have to understand how bizarre that is for Forbes, because generally speaking, we don't get involved in politics. And especially from the US, what I heard was very much the reputation of France as a business country is not great. You know, it's seen as very anti-entrepreneurial. And so I was set this challenge to go and do that. My amazing staff writer, Palmy Olsen, actually went out, interviewed President Macron. The fact-checking took 2.5 weeks, and it was really because I come from a broadcast background originally, and so it's a very different, much more reactive, much speedier, and then I've worked in online, which unfortunately hasn't always had the greatest fact-checking. And I'm really proud that Forbes really goes to that level. We were fact-checking exactly the colour of a badge on his lapel that we refer to in one of the parts of the story. And I think there really is a point for doing that at the moment. And in this time of lack of trust, actually, there's a reason why people will quote Forbes' valuations of billionaires and their net worth. You know, we have that trust. And internally, that's something that we're really pumping up. And what I was referencing with our presentational methods online, so we've created something called a daily cover, which is meant to mimic the wow that you have of a cover of a magazine. Those stories go through the same fact-checking process that we do for the magazine. And it's incredibly resource-intensive, but it's really paying off. And it's reminding people that actually Forbes is a voice to be trusted at the moment.
And that's interesting because, yeah, resource-intensive, it absolutely is. It costs a lot of money. And I guess in some businesses, some big media companies, there are your sort of bean counters, to talk disparagingly about our accountant friends, who will say, well, hang on, where's the payoff? But and it's a long game, isn't it, to get that value in terms of a perception of accuracy, a perception of veracity. Again, is that just partly because it's the way it's always been done there? Or do you think actually, maybe counterintuitively, that's what we need now more than ever? And actually, even if you were coming from a very diverse digital background, that idea about validity and accuracy, that's the new capital almost.
Yeah, I think from a very personal point of view, you're absolutely right. In my other life, I'm also a visiting lecturer at City University's Journalism School, and it's something that I just feel so passionate about. I've felt in the last 10 years that we have been so overwhelmed and so overloaded with information, particularly from digital, that I really see it as a cyclical change, and we're actually pulling back and starting to realise that we need to know where the truth is, and we need that trust needs to come back to the readers. And that it makes me really proud to work for an organization that's really thinking around that. And I think you're completely right. There's always going to be commercial pressures around that. And that is something that we're not immune to at all. But it's seen as such a critical part of the brand as well.
Just to pick up on a point you made earlier about looking at the correspondent network, you've mentioned several times this idea of maybe shifting some of the operational priorities, maybe it is, of the different international editions on your beat. What does that look like? It sounds potentially challenging.
Yes.
Has that been just something that's been kind of on your mind virtually from day one?
Yeah, it's just been sort of noticing those opportunities that there are those experts out there. And I think it's also born out of the contributor model that we have in Europe. So when I started a year ago, we had 80 contributors across the whole continent writing in English. And I'm really proud of my team, my producer, Alexandra, who has actually grown that from 80 to 400 in the space of under a year. And the contributor model, like, you know, I'll be honest with you, I think it's been controversial within journalism. Forbes were one of the first in the world to go into it. What's really interesting about it is as a journalist, sometimes we have to take a step back and we have to be more humble and we have to recognize that we don't know everything. Many of us are generalists by background. And actually, when you get the right people, we've got an economist, Frances Coppola, who is a career economist, a very accomplished person. And she has written some of the most interesting analytical takes on what's happening in Brexit I've seen. And it really changes my role as an editor when you start to see that you have this huge network of different voices and how are you going to stick them together? How are you going to present that view? And so I see working with our other European partners as an even bigger part of that.
Alex Wood, it's been an absolute delight. Thanks for coming to see us. That's Alex Wood, Europe editor for Forbes. And now to the world of fashion. Jamie Pearlman began her career working with Anna Wintour at American Vogue, eventually moving to become the creative director for British Vogue. But now Jamie has her own magazine, a hefty old tome called More or Less, which, although it touches on serious themes like sustainability, never loses its sense of fun. Issue 2 is out now, and Jamie spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco all about it.
With the magazine and when I launched it, the idea was to sort of celebrate creativity and make it fun and exciting and inject a bit of life into a fashion magazine. And especially when tackling a topic of sustainability and ethical fashion, it is very serious, it's very dry, and I don't feel like there's a platform yet that really makes it fun and exciting. And fashion is so creative and innovative, and you know, I think it's an opportunity for people in the industry to really have fun with the challenge that they're currently facing.
I love the logo as well. I think this could be put into a t-shirt very
easily.
I
know. Thank
you.
Joe Ratcliffe, the illustrator, made that for me. She did a great job. It's very iconic.
I mean, this is issue 2 with Amber Valletta on the cover. How was the reaction to issue 1? Because people usually say that when you prepare issue 2, that's the hardest thing.
Yes.
Even worse than the first issue.
I didn't know that. I wish somebody had told me that because it's true. And I this one almost killed me. But the first one, the reaction was fantastic. And my background, I had been at Vogue working there as creative director. And pretty much most of my working life, I've been working at Vogue. This is the first project I've done that was very visible, having left Vogue in 2017. So the first one was a really positive reaction. It was also really affirming to me, being able to get all these fantastic photographers and stylists to work with me doing my own project. And it was very affirming and great to know that all these people were sort of on board to work on this project with me when I don't have a big sort of institution behind me. I was really pleased. And then because the bar was high, I mean, I had Kate Moss on the first cover. This was really hard to sort of live up to that. And I just wanted it to be as good as the first one. And I've had such a great reaction. So some people like it more than the first one. So that's great.
And in terms of kind of distribution, you're American, but you're based here in the UK. So,
yes.
But are you trying to make this a kind of an international title?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a lot of stockists in the US and Europe, as well as Asia, and a little bit in Canada as well. So it is international.
And I was going to ask, I mean, of course, you worked at Vogue, so you clearly have a very close connection to fashion. And I can see that, you know, there's a lot of amazing brands, you know, advertising there as well. You talk a lot about sustainability. Do you only work with brands that you kind of trust that they are sustainable in a way? What's your approach with that?
Well, no. I mean, not everything in the magazine is sustainable. And in fact, the first issue was a bit more about inclusive price point. It focused on sustainability as well. The second issue is more directly about sustainability. However, it's not all sustainable. It's but the majority of it is playing around with concepts around the idea of sustainability. The Amber Valletta shoot has a lot of brands that are sustainable, that are current brands in it. So that's good. And we did a feature on Priya Awalia. I can't pronounce her name. She's this amazing young designer who just graduated from, I believe, St. Martin's. And she does a sustainable menswear line. And she just started off her career doing that. So I'm going off on a tangent. But basically, not everything is sustainable, but we wanted to sort of focus on the concept, vintage, craft, DIY, fun things. What I also wanted to do with the magazine is for people to get information that they couldn't get anywhere else. And when I grew up reading magazines as a teenager, I used to get Sassy and 17 magazine and all these magazines that kind of gave me information about how to do my makeup and how to get dressed and, you know, like tips and stuff like that. And With the DIY element, we followed around, in the first issue, we followed around a tailor and he tells you how to make a quilt out of scrap materials. In this issue, we followed around an artist called Mervine and he makes his trash into concrete sculptures and like his old iPhone and repurposes things. So it's kind of like fun ideas around taking waste and making something great out of it.
And reading the issue, you know, I discovered like amazing characters. I have to be honest, I haven't heard of Jane Mosley, for example, but you visited her house and then there's all sorts of pictures. That's
yes.
Amazing. I mean, it's such a delight, that photo shoot.
She's great. I mean, she's such a fantastic creative person herself. And she was always putting up photos on Instagram of her house. And I just was thinking, oh my God, this is so us. Like, you know, we have to go and visit her home. And she was great.
I love also there's a photo shoot. Is it about solitude? And such a beautiful imagery. I mean, there's something quite sad about it. I don't know why as well.
Yeah. Jamie Hawksworth, he did a road trip in America. Well, I guess it was America, Canada, and then Alaska over the summer. And I think he met people along the way, but essentially he documented all these beautiful solitary moments. The whole idea of finding beauty in something ordinary, I mean, that's kind of also the real ethos of what we are trying to do with the magazine as well.
And Jim, just a curiosity, I mean, I know you also worked at Vogue, but you also worked a lot in the visual part in films. I mean, are you still doing a little bit of that as well? Or is your life more or less 100%?
No, not at all. In fact, I'm a freelance creative director. I work with brands doing campaigns and creating content. And this is just sort of a part of the studio that I run now, having left Vogue.
And it's a biennial magazine, right? So issue 2 just came out literally in the newsstands. And
yes, I believe the issue 3 will be out in the fall.
That's amazing. And finally, Jamie, I would like to ask about your reads. I mean, are you a voracious reader of fashion magazines or other types of titles?
Yeah, I mean, I try to see as much as I can. I've always loved Gentlewoman. I think that Penny's an inspiration to me in what she does with that magazine. And how she created such a strong, specific point of view is really fantastic. I love Luncheon Magazine. I think that's like really a beautiful title. I love what Fran Burns does with Print Magazine, creating puzzles out of incredible photo shoots. There's lots of brilliant independent titles that I love.
How many pages are more or less actually? Well, I could have checked myself, but it's, 300 pages.
300 pages.
It's huge. I love it, you
know? Yeah.
I miss huge magazines. Yeah.
I know. It's very heavy. It's annoyingly expensive to ship to anywhere else. So I think when a lot of the international people buy the magazine online, the shipping might cost more than the cover price because it's only £10. You get a lot for your money. Mm-hmm. But if they buy it in store, it's cheaper.
But it's worth it, listeners.
Yeah, you get a lot for your money.
Jamie, thank you so much for coming here to Monocle 24.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Pearlman, editor and founder of More or Less, talking to Fernando. And finally on the show, a new publication all about female pleasure. Created by Gabriella Dietrichova and Cecilia Regini, the title is a welcome addition to newsstands. Gabriella and Cecilia spoke to Fernando about their new title, Vaginonomics.
I think why we did it is because we still felt like there was a bit of a gap there and there was a taboo. But we had a lot of issues also with the name and everything. So we tried to push it forward a little bit. We tried to find an angle that was a bit easier to approach for people that wasn't really into the subject and a bit embarrassed maybe. So that's why we talk about art and design.
Yeah, we wanted to be not just another feminist magazine, but also create a strong community around vaginonomics in general. That's why we feature predominantly only artists, because then first of all, the subject is more approachable. And second of all, also by talking to the people behind it, we stay in touch and we can work on future collaborations and create a beautiful community of like-minded people.
When you said that you had some problems with the name, why people were a bit shocked? And did you ever think perhaps we shouldn't use this name? But then you decided, no, that was our original plan, so let's do it.
It started as a project in university, so basically it didn't matter so much. But when I decided to take this forward, we decided to do a questionnaire, mostly around our environment to see if people would actually find it embarrassing or cool. So we gave a scale from 0 to 5, from least comfortable to most comfortable, and we had a huge gap. So a lot of people wear, oh, this is extremely cool, so super comfortable. And a lot of people wear, no, this is like, no, you can't use this. So that's also the reason why we decided to actually go for it, to sort of normalize the situation. So there is this huge gap in the middle of people that are not, okay, this is amazing, or, oh no, this is terrible. We need that people that is like, oh no, that's actually normal. So that's why we decided to push that.
Yeah, it's good to sometimes push forward things and be daring.
We tried, but unfortunately the government or the social media didn't think so. So our name got declined from all the different channels. So when we were registering the company, Vaginanomics wasn't allowed. So we are Vnomics, same with social media channels. So apparently this body part, which 50% of the population has, is still offensive to some.
Shocked. So social media groups, they rejected the name.
Yeah, that was a bit disappointing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Instagram was the only one that actually let us use the name Vaginanomics altogether. But on Facebook, the username is actually Vnomics again. And on Twitter, again, is Vagina_nomics. So we have three different taglines, which is quite terrible for branding, as you can imagine.
Let's be honest. I mean, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, he's a prude in a way, because it's interesting that on Facebook you see, you know, people's heads being chopped up, and then when you see like a female breast, oh my God, let's censor this. I find it shocking. That's actually shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. Also in our shop, most of the products can't be online on our shop on Facebook, because for some reason Facebook thinks it's offensive as well. So we like experience a lot of difficulties with this, and we're hoping that this will eventually change. Yeah.
Yeah, no, the guidelines on Facebook especially are very funny. Apart from the fact that we can't promote our products at all on Instagram, even paying for it, which is quite ridiculous. On Facebook, lots of products get rejected all the time. It's funny which one get rejected and which one can actually get approved. We had, for example, that was quite funny, a painting of Donald Trump, like in a super sexualized way, like with a body of a woman naked. So it was a pretty straightforward painting, and that was approved. And then we had a lovely print. It was a digital drawing of two guys, and it's written on top, "Let boys be feminine," and that was rejected. Wow. No nudity, no nothing.
But it's encouraging us to persist and continue with normalizing the process of normalizing this subject. So
when I have this lovely print product here, the magazine is out. So for example, if Stack listeners are listening, where can they find the physical copy of your magazine?
So at the moment we just have our store online, and we are organizing pop-up shops. So we are actually in a month and a half for March, for International Women's Day. We're going to be in Central St. Martin, just outside the university. We're going to have 2 days of pop-up shop, in which we're going to sell both our magazines and the work of art of the artists that we feature. We are very much negotiating, planning with different channels. We're trying to distribute it around London. It's still a work in progress, but we're working on it.
Amazing. Well, guys, congratulations. Thank you so much
for being here
on the Stack.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks, as ever, to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Cassie Galpin. You can send us comments, queries, or magazine suggestions. You'll find Fernando on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. Before we go, a little song here from the soundtrack of the film Party Monster. This is, appropriately for this week's programme, Money, Success, Fame, and Glamour. I'm Tom Edwards. Until next time, thanks for listening. Money, success, fame.